The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Well, good morning. Welcome to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. Also listening to us on 88.1 WSBR in Lee, Lenox, and Stockbridge. Watching us on PCTV Select and Access Pittsfield Channel 1301. Happy to have you on board this morning. It's Friday, October 3rd here, and we're live and local this morning in our WTBR studio right here on Federico Drive. Got a great show for you this morning. We have Mr. Alan Harris here. He is, of course, the CEO and Chief Investment Officer at Berkshire Money Management. And we have lots to talk about, lots going on in the markets, in the economy, the government shutdown that's happening right now, how that affects things. It's going to be a fantastic hour speaking with Alan and finding out some of these details and having a good discussion. So looking forward to that. First, let's get to our weather forecast one time here and see what the National Weather Service has on tap for us today. Here we go. Berkshire
Weather. WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area, rest of tonight, mostly clear. Near steady temperature around 40. Southwest wind around 5 miles per hour. Friday, sunny. Highs in the lower 70s. Southwest wind around 5 miles per hour. Friday night, clear. Lows in the mid 40s. Southwest wind around 5 miles per hour. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
All right, well, that's short and sweet. Not much going on there. Kind of nice and quiet. I'm looking outside the window today. See some blue skies out there. I don't see any rain in the forecast, which is nice. I hear it's going to be nice over the weekend as well. We're going to have a little bit of a bump up in temperature. Going to feel like summer again. That happened quickly, right? Enjoy it while you can. Good morning again. Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM. And good morning, Alan Harris. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Always good to have you here, and always have a good conversation about the economy and the markets and everything else going on around that.
If it happens to be shut down. Yeah,
that's kind of the theme for this morning, right? So here we are in the third day of the federal government shutdown, which I guess everybody kind of saw coming at some point. It was like a train wreck. It was just going to happen. But here we are. This is so far in the early days, I guess you would say, but doesn't look like there's anything happening on that front. Nobody's talking. There isn't any progress being made. We're in it right now, aren't we?
Yeah, so I will say the threat of a shutdown happens a couple times per year, and to the point where it's almost roll your eyes. And I, as someone who I write six columns a month and I produce four or five videos a month, you know, so I'm always looking for content. And I try to actually stay away from that as much as in the media, because it oftentimes makes us look like fools. We ring the alarm bell that this is going to happen,
yeah,
and then it doesn't. But I put a video out last week and I posted on LinkedIn. And said that, like, you know, by the time you see this, maybe it'll be done. But this time it seems like it's actually going to happen. It's actually going to stick.
Yeah.
And the sticking point seems to be at this point. The Affordable Care Act its funding is going to expire. Mm-hmm. And so some of the subsidies are going to be removed. And so the cost of health care for many Americans will increase by about 75%. So the Democrats want to move the needle on that. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting thing because the next funding will only last 50 days once this is approved. So there'll have to be another fight later on.
Only 50 days.
Yeah.
So it seems like they're just going to be ready to go back into the ring right after that.
Pretty much as soon as this is done, it'll probably be in the headlines again. And so, as you and I were talking about earlier on, like you said, this particular one looked like that slow-moving car crash. Mm-hmm. Like it looked like it was actually going to happen because there weren't a lot of negotiations that were happening on a very high level. And there aren't now. Mm-hmm. And the prediction markets, there's Kalshi and there's Polymarket, their federally regulated trading markets, has the over under at 11.1 days. And you and I are both saying, well, maybe the over this time.
Yeah. Yeah, it does look like it, doesn't it? Yeah. And yet, here we are in the third day of a government shutdown. You watch the markets. and you watch the averages, the Dow and the S&P and the NASDAQ, they're just shrugging this right off. It just seems like there's almost no effect, if anything. It looks like the markets are kind of enjoying this to a certain extent. We got new highs, new all-time highs. What's up with that?
Well, first, some numbers around that. So since 1980, there are things there's been 14 shutdowns. Mm. And most of the occurrences are one day, the second most occurrence is 2 days. It's rare to get into double digits. There's been a few times when it has.
Seems like it's getting longer and longer now, though, every time.
Well, it could be, or could be remember that, because the last time it was double digits, if I remember correctly, was 21 days back in during Clinton's time, and then there was 15 days, I think, in 2013, maybe something like that. Mm-hmm. So over those periods of times, you look at those occurrences about a week prior to the shutdown, the week after the shutdown, there will typically be a decline in the market of about 5%. Hmm. Interestingly, during the longest shutdown, during 2018, 2019, stretched to the calendar's year, during Trump's first term, the market actually rose, I think it was 5 or 6%, something like that. Hmm. So it's not necessarily that it's going to go down if there is a shutdown.
And there's long-term effects and short-term effects, right? Like you can watch what happens right around the time of the shutdown, and then you could look maybe 6 or 12 months down the road and say, what happens at that point?
And the longer the shutdown happens, certainly the longer the ripple effects, but they don't tend to happen long enough for it to matter. So typically the rule of thumb, the heuristic, is that if the government is shut down for about a year, it'll shave off about 0.1 percentage point of gross domestic product, GDP. Mm-hmm. So if GDP mm-hmm. was going to be 3%, it'll be 2.9%. Mm-hmm. So going back to 2018, 2019, that probably shaved off with 35 days, close to 0.4 percent.
Mm-hmm. And that seems like a pretty modest effect.
Well, it's a fairly modest effect, especially when it typically happens a day or two. Mm-hmm. But if it happens for a month, then it does take longer to regain that momentum and come back. Mm. And the reason why it tends to be very little impact is because that pause on GDP is usually just that period of time, because essential workers still have to go to work, so some things get done, but they don't get paid, and a lot of other furloughed workers do kind of get paid. Mm-hmm. But they tend to get paid, historically, have all been paid retroactively. Mm. So they get the money that they were able to spend before, mm-hmm. and they haven't gone, if it's only been 2 or 3 days, you're going to probably buy those things 2 or 3 days ago. Once you get into a month, that thing you might have bought a month, 3 weeks ago, you may not buy again. Mm-hmm. So it does a little bit more damage to the economy as you go out further.
Yeah. And then we're talking about potentially, 750,000 government workers in that range. I mean, it's a big chunk of people. What they'll be affected one way or another, whether they are essential and they're not getting paid, which means they're pulling from their savings probably to pay their bills, or they're furloughed or they're laid off, and in which case that has a longer term, effect on the economy. Got to affect the numbers at some point.
Oh, it'll certainly affect the numbers in terms of the GDP, and it'll affect the numbers in terms of the data reporting that's out there. So yes, the term essential is an odd one. Let's all just agree on that. That's not one that you and I created. Mm. But for example, in the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which I'm not sure how many people they employ in the organization, but let's say 10,000. Maybe it's 5,000. Mm. I really don't know. But there's only one person in the BLS who's deemed essential. They're probably not going to be able to do the work of these, 5,000 people, whatever the number. I really just don't know.
Right. So why at that point even have one person keeping the lights on in the building?
That's pretty, make sure you clean up the coffee pot, I guess. I don't know. So there's going to be some essential workers that are around, but you're still just not going to get things done. Mm-hmm. And it's probably important to note that this is what's called a partial shutdown, meaning that the organizations, the elements, the bureaus that are shut down are the ones who are not going to be funded for the next 50 days. Some of the funding elements for other organizations were already put in place and will continue. Mm-hmm. Right. So, for example, TSA will still be up.
Right. And so you could see some effects, for example, on transportation, but they might be minor because you still have to, again, have TSA folks. You have to have people. Air traffic controllers are essential.
Air traffic controllers are essential. They'll have to keep working. Amtrak is, speaking just of travel, will keep going because they were funded.
Yeah. But then last time, because of the length of the shutdown or the partial shutdown, you also saw some sick outs, right? You saw some people basically saying, en masse, okay, I'm sick today, I'm not coming in. And so now you know, you've got some issues.
Well, and then the issues even get bigger because some of the conversations have moved from temporary furloughs to permanent termination.
And that's kind of the first time we've heard that language during a shutdown, right? So that hasn't actually happened yet that we know of, although it's only day three.
It hasn't happened yet. I'm sure it's not just because we know of. I mean, I feel like if it had been done, it's going to be reported on. We know like almost instantaneously.
Yeah.
So unless something's changed in the last 10 minutes, it has not happened yet.
Well, but you know when news dumps happen, it's Friday night.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Here we are on Friday. So I'm just saying.
Yeah, exactly.
That's when things happen.
Yeah. And we also just don't really know how that's going to play out with President Trump. It's always, is it the part of the art of the deal or is it really going to happen or not? So it's always hard to predict what the economy is going to do. But it's even harder when you're not really sure what is threat versus promise.
Mm-hmm. And let's throw this into the mix. The idea that when the government shuts down, we don't get certain pieces of information to decide how the economy is doing, right? So today is typically a jobs day. It's a jobs report for September. We're not getting those numbers today from the federal government. We had an ADP report, which is a private company, a couple days ago, which kind of gave us an indication that there was a loss in terms of ADP jobs on Wednesday. But today we should hear from the BLS. It would be the jobs numbers coming through, and what do we have? Nothing, right?
Because
how do we make decisions based on that?
Because it's only that one essential worker that's at the BLS. So I don't want to say it's good news, but we search for alternatives intended to be in the private area. So you mentioned ADP, which is a payroll provider. And the thing about ADP is it doesn't get as much notice as the monthly payroll numbers, but ADP tends to have a better sample size and a survey mechanism. So all the revisions you get on the BLS payroll reports, and they tend to be massive amounts of them, they tend to revise back what the ADP says anyways, quite frankly. But the markets don't trade that way, but the economists know it, sort of thing. And then there's other tools. You know, the Dallas Fed, was it Dallas or Chicago, releases information on payrolls. And then there's Challenger Grain Christmas. So there are some private providers that are out there. And the Dallas Fed, forgive me, I just remember if it's Dallas or Chicago, but one of the Feds, Challenger Grain Christmas and ADP all had fairly consistent numbers. Mm. And
it's possible to piece together some of that information that we would normally have gotten from the BLS numbers.
It is. It is. And, you know, on payrolls is interesting. So it's certainly been trending down.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a big immigration component to this in artificial intelligence as well. In the beginning of the year, the first 3 months, it was pretty good rate of growth, about 111 net jobs. Mm-hmm. And it's net jobs because there's layoffs and there's hirings.
Yeah.
The second quarter went down closer to, I think it was 53, 60,000, something like that. Mm-hmm. And then the last few months has been flatlined to negative. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics actually breaks out the employment reports in tranches, age tranches. And it's, you know, for people my age, I'm 52, it's fairly similar to the national average of 4.3%.
Mm-hmm.
But if you get down to the younger tranche, 16 to 24, it's closer to 10%.
Yeah, much higher.
It's really hard for young people and new college graduates in particular to find jobs right now.
Yeah, and do we attribute that to an AI boom? Is that something, is that a factor?
Yeah, so...
in other words, are the AI taking the younger people's job, those entry-level jobs, where the companies are looking at that and saying, well, instead of hiring somebody, we can just put this, you know, work to AI and get some more productivity out of it.
It absolutely is. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't account for all of it, of course. There's other factors in terms of, the Royal We for businesses did a lot of hiring, hoarding when we couldn't get employment, couldn't get employees back in 2001, 2002. So we sort of filled those roles.
Mm-hmm.
So that has a little bit to do with it. But artificial intelligence is kind of stamping in on those roles that brand new employees that you're hiring to do the, I guess, more menial tasks, quite frankly, and exposed him to more sophisticated tasks over time. And employers are saying, listen, I can just be efficient right now. And instead of hiring this new young person to add very low value, and it's essentially an investment over the few years that they come into their own,
right.
I'm going to skip that investment portion of it and just go straight to AI tools. And when I say AI, People often conflate AI and large language models like ChatGPT and Claude and Perplexity. There are software packages that API that connect into those that are industry specific that are really being pretty helpful in terms of replacing young workers.
So a company might have a custom piece of software that draws from the AI and does what that industry needs.
And it doesn't even have to be custom. We'll talk about my industry, for example.
Sure.
So my company, Berkshire Money Management, it's a financial services company. And one of the things we'll do for young people who are coming in want a career arc to being a financial advisor, which is they sit what we call second chair. They'll sit in, they'll perhaps ask a question, perhaps answer a question, but primarily they're going to take notes and think about that. Mm-hmm. And it's helpful for them to be exposed, the whole osmosis thing.
Yeah.
But it's also helpful for the advisor because they get to be more present and not have to necessarily take the notes.
Mm.
There are tools, automatic AI note taker tools, and we have a couple of them actually. Mm. And it's a note taker.
Yeah.
And what it does is allow the advisor to be very present, and the AI note taker will then summarize all the information.
Mm-hmm.
We can then automatically put it into our record system so that we have that available. And then we have a meeting with this client later on. The notes are there and we can pull up very quickly. So we don't need the second chair advisor to do that lower menial task.
Mm-hmm.
But when they don't need to do that, it takes them away from that career arc because what else are we going to have them do to start in the bottom?
And that's the thing, right? That's a really critical first step for a lot of people coming into the jobs market, that getting that first real world experience, being there. You might not have the greatest responsibilities, but you're soaking it all up, right? You're figuring out how things work in a company and how the industry works. And if you don't have that experience, how do you get to that next level? And that's a bigger story because you can't stop the progression of technology. As we've seen, you're not going to stop typewriters. You're not going to stop word processors. You're not going to stop Microsoft Word. I mean, all the things, all the productivity software and the internet and everything that we've seen in the last 20, 30 years, that's never going to go away. And we know that that has changed the feeling of work what it is to be in a group, in an office, in a company, those kinds of things. But this seems to be more fundamentally changing in some way, that you're actually taking away some of those first opportunities for people.
Yeah, and I will say, so I am very pro-technology, I'm very pro-innovation, yeah. I'm very pro-industrial revolution in terms of however you might want to define it. I mean, whether it's steam in the 1880s, and then it went to electricity, and then it went to the digital revolution, and now the AI revolution. Some would say this is sort of the fourth wave of industrial revolutions.
Right.
And there's always winners and losers. Ultimately, historically, there's been more winners than losers for the grander populace and for improvement of per capita GDP. Basically, everyone's worth goes up. But yeah, there's going to be some disruption on the lower side. Mm-hmm. And even this last quarter, it's interesting. So there's a lot of inequality, but there's been a lot of improvement for people too. So the second quarter, I just don't have the data for this past quarter. Yeah. It's 2 days behind. But the second quarter of this year, the bottom 50% of earners in the U.S., their net worth increased by a totality of $150 billion, which is not bad. But wait, there's more. The top 10% increased by $5 trillion.
Right.
So $150 billion sounds nice until you compare it to $5 trillion.
Which is...
But it is pulling up everybody.
It pulls up, but certainly at different rates. And it is still increasing the wealth inequality of the two. Does portend some bigger societal problems, which may be out of the scope of what we're talking about here this morning with Alan Harris. And Alan is the CEO and Chief Investment Officer at Berkshire Money Management. We're happy to have him on Morning Drive this morning. And before we move on from the government shutdown, just one more question about government statistics in general. There's been a lot of talk about the Bureau of Labor Statistics and whether there should be some better reporting on that. There are a lot of revisions when it comes to those numbers. You might get a number today, but then you'll get a revision for the last 2 or 3 months or the last 6 months or something, because it's survey data, right? You're really, the BLS typically will survey employers, that information comes back, and then they say, oh, you know what, we didn't count that all completely, we didn't have that data, now we do, and we can tell you that the jobs were better or worse, you know, 3 months ago than we thought they were. So first of all, you know, does the administration have a point that there's a problem with BLS numbers, or are we just trying to manipulate that so we, the administration gets the numbers that it wants?
I don't think there's manipulation going on. I just think it's bad process. Mm. And a few months, so a month-ish ago, there was a revision to the payrolls and they erased away roughly a million jobs that they said they were created was not.
Yeah.
In April, I think it was, I put in writing in one of the columns I did, this is going to be, I calculated 980,000. Mm. I am not a top-tier economist in the Federal Reserve, taking all this million, this is one person, one access to all the public data that's out there,
yeah.
And I nailed the revision 3 or 4 months before it happened. Mm. And that's not me because I'm smart, it's just the point I'm trying to make is, this is information that is known, it's just not reported in a timely fashion. Mm. And I shouldn't say known hardcore because it was took some interpretation and some art and a little digging to kind of get to it, and it wasn't actually presented to itself, so you have to kind of dig that and tease that out. But it was available enough for me to determine that, and that's not a one-time thing. I've done that in the past. Mm-hmm. And others have too. It's not just me.
Yeah.
But in order to not have those revisions, you need a different process. Mm. The process right now is basically the Bureau of Labor Statistics will send you a form. I've talked to people who have gone through the payroll form and said that, you know, maybe they're not the most productive people. They've told me it takes them a couple hours. Mm. I don't understand why it takes so long. They told me about it. I didn't see it. But so you get a piece of paper. It says, if you don't do this, you're in trouble. So people are compelled to do it. But okay. Other people realize, like, that's kind of a hollow threat. So they'll put it in the two box and maybe never get to it. They'll put it in the recycling bin and they definitely aren't going to ever get to it.
Right.
And so if they do ever get to it, they get it past the payroll period. They, being the BLS, receive it past the payroll period. And that tends to be what the revisions are. Mm. Because you get the answers, but you get them late and then you have to revise it. But the other problem is the participation rate. This is directionally accurate, but not precisely correct because I just don't remember the numbers. But, you know, you go back 15 years, participation was closer to 60%, pretty good sample size. Now it's closer down to like 20%.
Huh.
So
companies are just not paying attention to it as much and just saying, well, it's not important to me to fill out this data and send it back.
They kind of figure that letter doesn't have as much teeth as it did, mm-hmm. you know, when, mm-hmm. at least what they thought that it did initially. Mm-hmm.
And of course, these numbers are all backward looking, right, in a way, is that you're always looking at what happened before. It's not a leading indicator. You're not looking ahead and saying, where do we think the jobs picture is going? Where do we think the economy is going to be in 3 months, 6 months? That's a different indicator.
I would argue that it could be a leading indicator, but only in so much that you then extrapolate a trend that could continue, and you have to, of course, pull in other variables to decide whether or not that trend will continue. For example, the trend of essentially zero growth for the last 3 months, will that continue? It probably will. Mm. However, should we get really freaked out about that? And I would argue maybe not. There's a term called break-even rate in the jobs market. And it's changed over, you know, again, directionally accurate, not precisely correct, because this part is kind of an art. Mm. I'd say 3 years ago, the break-even rate was about 130,000. What does that mean? Mm. Is so long as 130,000 net new jobs are created per month, the unemployment rate would stay about where it is.
So it's like neutral in a way,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
It's kind of where we should be in that particular time with those external factors that we have. That's
exactly
what we would expect.
Going back about 5 months, it went from 130,000 perhaps to about 50 to 80. Again, this is more art than science. And I would argue it's closer to about 20-30 now. People smarter than me argue it's probably closer to 30-50. But the point being, you don't need as many jobs right now being created on the net basis in order to keep unemployment rate fairly in check. And it has a lot to do with there simply being fewer workers. Mm-hmm. With net immigration being neutral,
yeah.
That means there's not people looking for those jobs. So the unemployment rate stays about steady with a very low net creation.
Mm. And of course, all of that winds back to the thought of potential recession, which we seems like we've been talking about for 4 years now since the pandemic finished up. Everybody had been predicting a recession in 2022 and 2023, and that never happened, and here we are again. When you see jobs numbers in that range, it doesn't immediately tell you, oh, I think we're headed for a recession, right? If you're still seeing positive 30 to 50,000 net jobs, that doesn't say that's where we're headed.
Yeah, so I like to use a different definition of a recession than the more... So the unofficial, official arbiter of recessions is the National Bureau of Economic Research, NBER. Mm-hmm. And they define it as a broad and persistent decline in economic output. Mm. And I grew up in old school, kind of like if you have two calendar quarters of negative GDP growth, that's a recession.
Right.
So we had it back in early 2022... revisions. Hmm. Then we didn't have it in early 2022. And I think if you have two quarters of negative growth, that should be called a recession. Hmm. Some people will call what's going on right now a jobs recession. And I think that is accurate because you're defining that it's a recession, but not in the broad way that the National Bureau of Economic Research would say. Hmm. But there is a recession in this particular area.
Yeah. And the jobs market right now seems to be basically in a frozen state, right, where employers are not necessarily hiring a lot, but they're also not laying off a lot of people, and people are sort of holding on to the jobs that they have. That seems to be where we stand. I don't know if that's an anecdotal characterization of it, right? Who knows what's really going on the ground, but that seems to be where people are.
It's so interesting. You just said it was anecdotal because I was going to say I have anecdata, so which is when you get enough stories behind it, it becomes data. Mm. You need lots of points in order to make it data, but if you hear enough, then you kind of know it. And so you're spot on. Mm. And part of that is a reflection of, you know, employers still remember the pain of not having the employees they needed a few years ago. And so we're reluctant to let them go. And it's really hard to let employees go. Yes, there's the vibe part of it. You don't want to do that. Mm. But from a cost standpoint, it's really hard to retrain these people when you need them back again.
Yeah, that has a real cost.
And quite frankly, the economy is doing well enough where, why? Mm. Why would you want to cut some of your employees? Well, I say why. Let me answer my rhetorical question. If you're a small business, kind of mom and pop-ish, then it's a true rhetorical question because you're probably not going to do that. Mm. If you're a larger corporation and you have a technology consultant that works with you, or you are savvy enough to hire and outsource a team, then you can start finding the artificial intelligence teams to go ahead and reduce your headcount. Mm.
And it's interesting, the one that pops into my mind recently is Starbucks announcing that they were closing, you know, hundreds of stores and laying off people. And you can't get AI to make you a good cup of coffee.
Well, that part just makes, I mean, if I go down to New York City, the joke is always, oh, look, there's a Starbucks, because in every corner there's a Starbucks.
Yeah, no doubt.
And a lot of the Starbucks that are closing, as I understand it, CEO, I think his name is Nichols. He came in year and a half ago, replacing the other CEO. The idea is here, a lot of the shops that are closing are takeout only. And so you can, there's people there making the coffee, but it's kind of when you use your app, you just go up and grab the coffee. He wanted to create more of an experience. So you can't have the experience by just picking it up. You want people to come in. So as I understand it, most of those are the takeouts. That's what I read.
Yeah. Interesting.
I didn't talk to him.
Maybe we should. We'll bring him on the show here. We'll find out what's going on at Starbucks. Alan Harris is my guest here this morning on Morning Drive. He's the CEO and Chief Investment Officer at Berkshire Money Management. And we've still got a lot to talk about, Alan, as we get through the second half of the show here. It's actually been 6 months since we last talked to you. And the last time we had you on, another significant event in the economy had happened, and we called that Liberation Day. And that was the introduction of this huge tariff regime, which the likes of which we have never seen here in the United States, using a quote. So we want to get a recap of that in the second half of the show about the report card of that experience. How are tariffs affecting the markets and our economy? Or maybe the report isn't completely finished yet. So we'll talk to Alan about that in just a moment here on Morning Drive, 89.7 WTBR FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. We'll return right after this and find out all more that we can find out. Here we go.
Tune for more Morning Drive here on WTBR FM.
You're tuned to Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR FM Pittsfield and 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. Free community college for any Massachusetts resident without a bachelor's degree at BCC. Find out more at berkshirecc.edu. And from Sundrini Awnings and Home Improvement, providing awnings and canopies in Western Mass. Retractable awnings, retractable screens, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings and screen rooms, customized solutions available. Online at sondrini.com.
Still paying for that monthly gym membership? How about that streaming service you never watch? Why not support WTBR-FM instead? For just $8.97 a month, you could show your support for our community radio station today. Go to WTBRFM.com and click donate. It's as easy as that. We need to support this station to keep it on the air, and every little bit helps. WTBR-FM, for the love of radio.
Some news outlets tell you what to believe, and they limit your access to the whole story. Some of them are just plain ugly and mean. Social media is filled with rumors, misinformation, personal attacks. Where locally can you get the whole story, unfiltered, so that you can make informed decisions at the ballot box? There's really only one place. It's on PCTV. On cable, on the PCTV Select app, and at PittsfieldTV.org. The whole story since 1986. PCTV. See it all and decide for yourself.
Hey, I'm Kyle.
And I'm Riley.
Do you like 90s alternative?
Do you like 2000s emo?
Are you tired of the same old predictable radio?
Tune in to Zennial Yearbook on WTVR. We're playing the best alternative songs from the 90s and early 2000s.
We're playing Green Day, Foo Fighters,
Blink-182, Weezer, and more My Chemical Romance than is required by law.
So tune your Walkman to 89.7 FM WTBR. Saturdays at 2 p.m. for all this and more.
It's Zennial Yearbook!
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org.
And from UCP of Western Massachusetts. UCP of Western Mass is hiring full and part-time opportunities to provide a life without limits for people with disabilities. For more information, ucpwma.org/jobs.
You have chosen wisely.
WTBR. And now back to the Morning Drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
All right, welcome back to the show here, Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio, also 88.1 WSBR in Lee. Watching the program on Access Pittsfield, Channel 1301, and PCTV Select on your app or on the website. Good morning. It's Friday, October 3rd, and we're here live in the studio this morning. It's about, 36 degrees, so we kind of had another cold morning out there. I hear we're going to get up into the lower 70s today, which will be nice. I'm looking outside right now and seeing the blue skies again. Very nice. Early October morning for you. Alan Harris is my guest this morning, and we'll get back to his conversation in just a moment. First, let's get to the weather forecast and see what we have in store for us coming up today. Here we go.
Berkshire weather. WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Rest of tonight, mostly clear. Near steady temperature around 40. Southwest wind around 5 miles per hour. Friday, sunny. Highs in the lower 70s. Southwest wind around 5 miles per hour. Friday night, clear. Lows in the mid 40s. Southwest wind around 5 miles per hour. Weather forecasts for WTBR FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
There you go. Enjoy the day today. It's going to be very nice. If you can get outside, that's definitely advisable. You're going to have a very nice weekend as well, so enjoy it while you can, while it's really nice out there and while we're not dodging the snowflakes. Anything's better than that, right? All right. Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR FM. Good morning again, Alan Harris from Berkshire Money Management.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here again.
Of course. Happy to.
So we kind of teased it at the end of the first half of the show, talking about the tariffs and Liberation Day. I think we had you on the morning that it hit in April. And we were talking about it because that was fortuitous. It's not like we called you up the night before and said, you got to come on and talk about Liberation Day. But we it just happened to be the right time. And here we are again, something that we had planned weeks ago. And now we have a government shutdown. But the tariffs, now that we have a 6 month.
Am I bad luck? Is that what you're implying?
Well, it's just good that we have something real to talk about when you come on. These are real things that affect people. You know, so the tariffs after 6 months. What's the report card look like? What has happened that we thought was going to happen, and what happened that we didn't think was going to happen?
Sure, sure. So first of all, bravo on your Trump impersonation by saying it's the likes of which we've never seen. and that part is actually accurate because so the Great Depression was in part sort of triggered by the Smoot-Hawley Act, the tariffs, and the early on in the days of following Liberation Day, which is the day President Trump deemed, you know, they said here's the new, what he called reciprocal tariffs, and mathematically they simply weren't reciprocal. There was a whole different calculation that we won't get into here.
Right.
The rate would have been way past what Smoot-Hawley was, and over the course of the next month or so, it was actually, the effective rate was higher than Smoot-Hawley. It's now come down between a combination of negotiations and just, you know, having a lower baseline from which to go ahead and not negotiate or pause some things. The effective rate is closer to about 10%, which is still pretty darn high. Yeah.
Depending on the country and depending on the industry, right? Like steel and aluminum might be a little bit more. Chips from certain countries and technology, things like that might be more. It seems like it's arbitrary and capricious to a certain extent. There are some that are just higher because the administration wants them to be higher on that particular country, so it's kind of uneven, right?
Absolutely. So the effective rate isn't regarding any specific country or industry or product. It's the amount of tariffs they're taken in divided by the amount of goods that are imported. And for comparison, again, directionally, I cannot precisely correct, it was 2 or 3% prior to Liberation Day. So a jump from 2-3% to 10%, 10-12%. It's pretty significant.
Right.
And there's an immediate concern and a longer concern. The immediate concern was the possible chaos that would be from reshaping the U.S. Treasury system from one from, hey, we're going to go from an income tax base to collection of revenue to a tariff tax base.
Right.
And we see now that that's not the case. So the peak chaos is beyond that. There's still uncertainty, and there's uncertainty indexes, believe it or not, that are out there. And a lot of times, mostly that measures certainty or uncertainty in purchasing managers, CEOs, CFOs, and, you know, like what daylight do they have in terms of what can I buy now that isn't going to be the prices are going to move a lot in the next day or a month or anything like that. So there's still a lot of uncertainty there. But that has come down a lot, and people seem to be able to make better decisions, but not perfect decisions because there's still capricious. You used the word earlier on. There's still a lot of capriciousness in terms of like how it is applied, and is it meant to be reciprocal? Is it meant to be negotiation? So it's
hard to know.
It's far from perfect.
Yeah. And also, so what kinds of direct effects has it had, say, on inflation? Have we seen an uptick in inflation due to the tariffs?
Yes. The quick answer is yes. So we've seen it come down. So the most popular, there's a lot of different ways to measure inflation, but the most popular one is Consumer Price Index, CPI. And that, you know, it was trending down. It was, you know, 3.1-ish in Q1, first quarter of 2025. It went back up a little bit in the second quarter, and then a little bit more in this quarter. I'll get pretty precise on this, actually. So inflation is important, of course, for all of us because it's, you know, our wages are going to be used to buy things, and the more expensive things are, the fewer of those things we can buy, or the fewer other things that we might want to be able to buy on a discretionary basis. And it pushes down the economy.
Right.
We can't buy these things. And then, of course, it gets into jobs. But also has this other effect, too, which is if you're looking at the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve has a couple mandates, a dual mandate, it's called. One is to keep employment stable. And the other part is to keep inflation stable. And they have a target of 2%. And they use something called the PCE, Personal Consumption Expenditures Index. Mm-hmm. That's their measure of inflation. And it's was a 2.2 in April, and it was trending down. Then Liberation Day came, mm-hmm. and it trended back up to 2.7. That's not all attributable to the tariffs. A little bit of my math and a little bit of a $200 per month high-class ChatGPT thinking. it looked in some other people's reports, too, but I just like using ChatGPT's deep thinking. Mm-hmm. It's probably, would have been, instead of 2.7, probably 2.4 or 2.3. Mm. So the tariffs are absolutely having an impact on inflation, but it's not having the incredible amount of impact that we feared in the early days.
Now, is it that we just haven't seen the full effect of it yet?
You just stole it. Yeah, exactly what I was going to say. Yeah. So if you listen to a couple of Fed officials who have studied a lot of this better than I have, they will suggest that there's long and variable lags and tariff implications or tariff applications, where you are probably going to see a little bit now, but you're going to see more of it later on. And so the effect of inflation might be around for about another year and a half. Mm-hmm. They will call that a temporary. So it's interesting. So there's nuance in it, in this definition. So the increased prices from tariffs show up in inflation rate. However, they themselves are not inflationary. Sounds freaking ridiculous, right? Excuse my language. I'm sorry. Because at some point, it no longer adds to the growth of prices, and inflation is the growth of prices.
So basically, that means we kind of get used to it, right? It's a new pattern. So we know that now their tariffs are going to increase the prices by adding this extra tax that is sort of underneath that we're all paying. And then the economy sort of gets used to that, adjusts to it.
Well, yes. And then what happens is the law of supply and demand come back into it. Mm-hmm. And the tariffs happen as a one-time price adjustment. And then supply and demand is the cause that really is always there.
Yeah. Was some of it that importers and the suppliers and people, the buyers for companies, saw what was going to happen and said, we better stock up on this stuff because we don't want to have to pay, huge amounts of money when the tariffs do kick in. So we're just going to load up our warehouses for back to school and for Christmas time and for whatever else. And then when that supply runs out, now we're going to see a bigger increase. Is that something that could happen?
And you saw a lot of that. Mm. Yes. Mm. And you saw a lot of that in the first quarter. The first quarter, gross domestic product. So gross domestic product is consumption of households, investment by businesses, government expenditures, minus imports, so net exports. Mm-hmm. And it was GDP was minus 0.05. I forgot what it was. It was negative 0.5, something like that.
In that first quarter.
In the first quarter. Mm-hmm. And it would have otherwise been closer to about 1.9 if not for the fact that imports were being pulled into the market. Mm. And then it rebounded in the second quarter and is doing pretty well this quarter. It was essentially flatlined for the first half, if you put in that first quarter, and closer to 1.5% probably, if you just do the math in the back of my head, for year to date. Mm-hmm. So the tariffs are affecting prices, but it's not necessarily slowing down the economy.
Mm. And what about the other side, the purported benefit of the tariffs, which was supposed to be bolstering American manufacturing, right? That was one of the themes that was brought up a lot when tariffs were discussed, which is if we, are able to slap all of these huge tariffs on imports coming in, we'll slow that growth so that more people will manufacture things in the United States and then people in the United States will buy things that were manufactured in the United States. I know that's a long-term thing. Here it is 6 months later. Have we seen any evidence that that is a trend that's going to be happening?
Unfortunately not. Mm. So I want to be generous about this, though, because I don't want to come across as like bashing the administration, because I want to give an objective opinion as possible on this. So first of all, even if it was going to work in the long term, it wouldn't work in the long term because you have a new administration that could come in and take the tariffs away. Now, whether or not they would or not, who knows? Mm-hmm. Like when Trump had all of his tariffs in the first term, Biden kept them all on and actually added some additional ones. So it may not. The effect it's having on creating factories in the U.S. Seems not to be working if your goal is jobs, because the jobs for construction, for example, last month were negative 19,000 using ADP reports. Maybe it was 13, something like that. And it was flat or negative for the quarter before, I forgot. But I mean, so the construction jobs don't seem to be materializing. And to the extent that they are materializing, well, let me take one step back. To the extent that they would materialize, they probably wouldn't in some grand fashion, because the reason a lot of these plants are built internationally is because the labor is a lot cheaper. Mm-hmm. And so even with tariffs, it would still be a price advantage, as long as the tariffs weren't too high, to continue investing where they were. Mm. Not only that, but then to move into the U.S., you have to create brand new infrastructure and hire people who don't have that skill and train them. It's a big, giant lift. So it's just a lot easier to sit back and do nothing, which is probably one of the reasons why you haven't seen any materialization. These things would, even if it were to happen, let's say the company's got past that, it takes a long time to do that.
Yeah.
So you're not going to see it right away.
Making those decisions is a long-term process. Yeah. And I would imagine if they see the uncertainty that they've seen in the past 6 months, there isn't just one general direction of saying, oh, I know exactly what's going to happen now, so now I can base a business plan on that, and I can invest billions of dollars in making new plants in the United States. Those decisions doesn't seem to be forthcoming. Maybe a lot of showy announcements and things, but what are the actions?
So regarding the showy announcements, let's be generous to the administration. Mm-hmm. Tariffs have been pretty instrumental in getting revenue. I hate saying getting revenue because essentially small businesses have been taxed.
Yes.
So for those listening, I just rolled my eyes hard. you can say great, we got revenue, but really it's a big tax in small businesses. Yeah. Again, being gracious toward the Trump administration here, he's been able to negotiate or leverage the threat of tariffs by getting a lot of countries to say they're going to spend a lot of money, like to the tune of a couple of $1 trillion. I lost track. Like an enormous amount of money. Mm-hmm. The problem is he also had that done in the first term, and very little of that money that was pledged actually made its way into actual spending. Mm-hmm. So if these pledges that came from the threat of tariffs come to play, my goodness, it is going to be boomtown in the U.S. Mm. No doubt about it. But there's been very little evidence of it actually occurring. And the evidence of it actually occurring has mostly been from artificial intelligence companies who are investing in their data centers, who are going to have to do that anyways. And they were just able to get capital partners from basically sovereign wealth funds to help out.
And everything that comes along with building the data centers, like the infrastructure and the power and everything else needed for those data centers, right?
Yeah.
And that's a tremendous tail to it. Alan Harris is my guest here this morning. If you're just joining us on Morning Drive, 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio, and talking about the economy, the government shutdown, tariffs, all kinds of stuff that, believe it or not, even if you've tuned it out and you say, I don't know anything about that, it doesn't affect me, I'm just going to go along with my daily life, sometimes it punches you in the face, and just like Mike Tyson said, right? So we want to keep up on these things and make sure that people get a little bit of information and know what's happening around them and why it's important to them. Let's talk about mortgage rates and Fed rates. Again, sometimes people hear the news that the Federal Reserve has lowered its short-term interest rate, its overnight rate between institutions, right? It went down in the September meeting by a quarter of a point. And I think a lot of people turned to that and said, okay, good, my loan rates are going to be going now. I can get a mortgage for a better rate. And they look at the mortgage rates and they say, how come mortgage rates are either flat or going up again?
So a couple quick contextual things, just so we can have this conversation. So first of all, 30-year mortgage, which is a fixed mortgage, which is the traditional mortgage that people will buy. I didn't look at the average coming in, but it's probably about 6.4, 6.5, something like that. 6.4%, 6.5%. And it reached it touched below 3% back in, I don't know, 2020-ish, 2021, something like that.
Yeah.
But a big part of that wasn't just because interest rates were low. It was because the Federal Reserve was buying everything.
Mm.
They were increasing their balance sheet because that was stimulant to the economy. And one of the things they were buying was mortgage-backed securities.
Mm.
And the demand for mortgage-backed securities pulled down mortgage rates. So we're not going to see that pull down from the Fed. Just they're not doing that right now.
There would have to be a major external event of some kind that would change the dynamics of everything, right?
Yeah. So we're going to lose that percentage point or two they would have got from that otherwise. So the Federal Reserve dictates what's called the federal funds rate, which is a borrowing rate, an overnight borrowing rate that banks will, our local banks will borrow mm-hmm. at the rate at which they'll borrow from the Federal Reserve banks. And what you'll typically see is a correlation closer to the 10-year Treasury, not the Federal Reserve's Reserve note, although those two things are a little bit correlated. Yeah. And so what you usually see is a spread, a range, about 140 basis points, well, 1.4% or 1.8 percentage points, excuse me, points, not percent, it's important, above the 10-year note. Mm-hmm. So if the 10-year, which is currently around, we'll call it 4%, just for easy math, you traditionally see something like a 5.4% to 5.8% range.
So basically there's a spread between that 10% bond, right, the government bond, and what banks and other financial institutions will lend their money out. And that spread is all the money that they take for whatever they're doing, you know, the risk that they're incurring over the course of that money or whatever. So you're always going to see that, 2 to 2.5% difference between those.
Yeah, so on the Federal Reserve, so
between that and the mortgage,
sticking with the 10-year though, let's call it just 1.5 percentage points to make life easy. So if the 10-year is currently at 4,
mm-hmm.
you'd expect the 30-year mortgage to be about 5.5. Mm-hmm. It's closer to 6.5 right now.
Right.
So why is it higher? Well, supply and demand. We need to build, we collectively, builders in the U.S. need to build approximately 400,000 more houses per year than they currently are in order to keep up with demand.
Mm.
There are simply way more home buyers than there are homes available for sale. The inventory level is pretty darn low.
Hence the housing crisis and the cost of owning and renting a place.
Yeah,
difficult.
Inflation is a measure of a bunch of things, and a big part of that is actually rent. We'll just say housing. I want to get into the details of it. And that's like 30% of the basket or something like that. It's very big. And since the pandemic, The median home price is up something like 35-40% or something like that. And so you've seen inflation go up a lot because of that. And mortgage rates will probably stay high because people want to buy houses.
Yeah.
And they can't find the houses.
Right.
So it's supply and demand.
Excuse me. And also the overall age of people buying those houses is slowly going up as well, right? Fewer younger people are getting into their first house. The millennials and traditionally been sort of squeezed and aren't able to have that buying power for things like houses and cars and things that a previous generation would have had.
Yes, and I had an interesting conversation with someone recently who said the American dream is less achievable. If you define the American dream by a couple of different things, family, kids, and having a house. And I argued, well, maybe the American dream that you had is different than the American dream the younger people have. They're selectively not getting married until later in the years. Mm-hmm. They're selectively not having children
until later in the years, or as many. Mm-hmm.
And they're also finding the freedom of being able to rent and to determine whether or not they want to buy later on and have some freedom to move across the country. They can work wherever they want because, you know, there's a lot of work from home scenarios. So you're absolutely seeing older people buy more houses for that reason, because the American dream has the definition of it has changed for younger people, which is great. Do you absolutely. But also, quite frankly, it's easier for older people who have generally more income to save up for that,
or more assets
to save up for that what can be very unachievable down payment nowadays.
Yeah. And then, of course, that kind of leads us to the next topic real quick here. We talk about, and we could do a whole show on this, stagflation. And we hear that word tossed around a little bit. Anyone who was around in the 1970s will remember how difficult it was under those circumstances to have an economy that was sluggish, that wasn't growing very well, the fewer, you know, job opportunities and things like that, at the same time having very high inflation. And the Fed, as we talked about before, has that dual mandate of keeping inflation under control and also promoting the best jobs growth that there can be. What does the Fed or any part of the administration do when it comes to fighting stagflation?
There's very little you can do, because the tools for the tools the Federal Reserve has, and they're the ones who would really be targeting it, because stagflation is inflation, mm-hmm. and growth, and a big part of growth is job growth. And so it's hard to talk about growth of the economy without having to talk about growth of jobs. Sure. That's where the mandate is. And there's going to be less Fed independence, and I think a greater acceptance of a 3% target than a 2% target by the Fed. So that's going to be, by most people's definition, high inflation, even if they keep it at 3%. I will say I am more optimistic on the economy. Now, granted, over the last three quarters, this quarter looks to be pretty good. Previous quarter, not bad. And the first quarter, sucked. Sorry, language. Yeah. Flatline-ish for the last three quarters. But I'm pretty optimistic on the economy. I see more likelihood of a boom in next year than I do a recession. Hmm. And this is coming from a guy. I get emails back from, so we send out an email out once a week from about 3,000, 4,000 people. And I'll get emails back from people like, why do you sound so bearish, like, all the time? Like, well, my job is to assess risks. I manage portfolios. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Mike Tyson earlier on. I said, you know, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. Yeah. I have to make sure I'm ready to bob and weave and get punched in the face. So I try to check out all the possible risks. And so I'm always looking for what could push us into a recession and what that probability might be. And while I have a long list of them, stagflation is on that list. Mm-hmm. I think the more probable scenario is growth, as opposed to stagnant economy.
So a lack of growth, essentially. Or growth that will have better growth.
Oh, I think we'll see growth. I think that economic stimulus from the One Big Beautiful Bill, Act, I guess at this point, is passed into law, no matter what your political ideology may be, combined with the enormous amount of private equity being put into the non-public companies in the data center infrastructure, artificial intelligence making people more productive. I think that instead of having a 2% GDP, you're probably going to be closer to 2.5-3.5% GDP.
Well, that's a good outlook. And
it is.
So looking at that and hearing that near the end of the show here, as we've only got about a minute left with Alan Harris talking about the economy and markets. If people are in the market or are looking to keep a plan going for their retirement, what do you tell them right now?
Be super careful. We didn't really get into the stock market. The stock market is very expensive right now. Mm. The economy and the stock market are correlated by two different animals. And so while I do see a lot of promise for the economy, you know, I try to think about what could go right, and I see a lot of things that could go right. The stock market is just very expensive right now.
Yeah, very high valuations, right? The stock market being, two poles, right? Fear and greed. Yeah. And so right now it seems like we're in the greed area where things are just going higher, higher, higher.
I once heard someone describe the stock market as a chart of rich people's feelings. I'm like, yeah, that sounds about right.
I like that. Yeah, and Warren Buffett had some great things to say about that too, right? Be fearful when others are greedy, and be greedy when others are fearful.
Well, speaking of Buffett, I mean, there's a valuation tool called the Buffett Indicator, where it takes basically all the public companies and divide that by gross national product, and if it's currently at 217%, 80% would be considered cheap. Mm. It was about 150% at the beginning of 1998. We got into the technology bubble. In 1999, it hit 200%. Mm. So at 217%, that's higher than the tech bubble.
Yeah. So that's where we are. Keep that in mind. Make decisions as you will. And Alan Harris from Berkshire Money Management, been a very helpful, useful conversation, as it always is here this morning. If people want to get a hold of you, how do they do that?
Probably best on our website, berkshiremm.com, and you can sign up for our weekly newsletter there.
That's great. Well, we appreciate you being here, and I don't think we got to every question, but there's so much going on. Hopefully the next time we have you on, there isn't another major thing that's changing the entire economy or markets, but who knows? It probably will. We appreciate you being here today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. All right, everybody. Have a great weekend out there. It sounds like it's going to be nice. Get outside. Enjoy it while you can, and we'll see you back here again next week for Morning Drive. Take care.